The following message is brought to you by MacArthur Boulevard Baptist Church. We are many stories made one family by one gospel. If you would like to connect with us, please check out our website at MacArthurBoulevard.org.
If you do have a copy of God's Word with you this morning, I invite you to open it and find the book of Exodus. If the Bible is new to you, you should know that it is one story that is made up of 66 different individual books, and that the book of Exodus is at the beginning, just on the other side of Genesis. And we are excited this morning to start a new sermon series wherein, over the next several months, we're going to be walking through this book, the book of Exodus, in its entirety together. And as I thought about the best way to introduce Exodus to you this morning, I thought of a quote from one of my all-time favorite TV characters, a man that goes by the name of Ron Swanson. Now, if you don't know Ron Swanson, he is a character on the show Parks and Recreation. And if I could describe him to you, he has a thick Tom Selleck mustache. He loves bacon, and he's a libertarian. He hates the government, and he directs a government department, namely the Parks and Rec Department in the city of Pawnee, Indiana. And there's one point where he is talking about literature, and he's talking about his favorite book, Moby Dick. And this is what Ron says. He says, "I hate metaphors. That's why my favorite book is Moby Dick. No frou-frou symbolism. Just a good, simple tale about a man who hates an animal." And What makes the line so humorous, of course, is that, yes, while Moby Dick is a story about Captain Ahab's quest for vengeance against the great white whale, it is intended to be a paradigm of a much larger narrative, namely humanity's struggle against forces beyond its control. When you're reading Moby Dick, you're supposed to come to a point in the story when you realize this story about this guy and this fish is actually about something far greater than just the events that it is describing. And something similar should happen to us as we're reading the story of the Exodus. Now, to be clear, Exodus is not merely a metaphor. And what I mean by that is this is history. These stories are about real people in real places and about real events that actually transpired and took place on earth. But as we read the story of the Exodus within the context of the entire Bible, we begin to realize that this story of the Exodus is a paradigm of a much larger narrative, right? A much larger story. It is a story about a God named Yahweh and how he delivers a people from the slavery of an oppressive kingdom, and he delivers them to a new place, to be a new kingdom, to be a new people who love him and worship him and obey him and reflect his character, and in doing so display his glory among the nations. And as we're reading about this story, we realize that it's not just about a series of historical events that took place thousands of years ago. This is a story of God's past and present and future work. to redeem a people from an oppressive kingdom and into a new kingdom, his kingdom, which is not a kingdom characterized by slavery and the production of bricks, but is a kingdom that is characterized by sonship and rest. This is why Exodus has been called by many the gospel of the Old Testament. We learn in this story of the Exodus about the nature of this God, the Lord. And we learn about the nature of his redemption that we are experiencing even today through his Son, Jesus Christ. So I want to introduce you this morning to the book of Exodus. And even as you jump into the story in chapter 1, in these first few verses, it doesn't take long before you realize that you're actually jumping into the middle of a story that has already started to be told. Look right there. Go back to verse 1 of Exodus 1. This is how it begins. It begins by saying, "These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob." And then it goes on to list out the names of the sons of Jacob as if the reader is already aware of who Jacob is and who Israel is and the fact that they're already in Egypt, and why is it significant that they are in Egypt and how that they get to Egypt. And you begin to realize, okay, in order to understand this story, we're going to have to see the prequel to the story, which is actually given to us in the book of Genesis. Okay, we're going to see a few themes develop throughout the story of the Exodus, but those themes actually originate in Genesis. And each of those themes will reveal a particular truth that will help us to see the nature of this God. This God who reveals himself as the great I am, and the nature of what he's doing in the world. And so I want to get us ready for Exodus by looking at the prequel a bit this morning and seeing some themes that are going to carry over into the narrative. Now in Genesis, we learn that this Jacob fellow that's mentioned in Exodus 1:1 was actually the son of a guy named Isaac, who himself was actually the son of a guy named Abraham. Now we're going to talk frequently in this series about a very important biblical word. It is the word covenant. Covenant. Understand that a covenant is not the same thing as a contract, wherein, you know, in a contract you've got two relatively equal parties that enter into an agreement, and that agreement is in place insofar as those parties both fulfill their obligations to the contract. Covenants are of a different nature than contracts. Covenant is actually a word that means promise. Promise. And it's a particular type of promise. It's the kind of promise that doesn't have to be made. There's no obligation for it to be made. Instead, it's a promise that arises from the free decision of the promise maker. In other words, the promise maker is under no obligation to bestow this pledge, this promise, upon those who are receiving it. It is bestowed without merit. It is bestowed without bargaining. And we find out in the story of Genesis that God is going to make a promise, a pledge, with this man named Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. He tells Abraham, he makes this pledge that he's going to send him to a land, and he's going to give him this land where he's sending them. And not only is he going to give him this land, but he's going to make Abraham into this great nation. this multitude of people, this great nation. And then a few chapters later, Genesis 15, he enters into a formal covenant through a covenant ceremony where he takes Abram outside of his tent. He tells him to look up at the sky and count the stars. And he says, that's how many your offspring is going to be. And he says, this land that you're currently residing in a tent is going to be yours. I'm giving it to you. And so there are two aspects to the pledge, two aspects to the covenant promise, a place and a progeny, right? A land and a people, a nation, a multitude of offspring. Now, you might ask yourself, well, okay, what was Abraham's resume such that he deserves to receive such incredible promises? I mean, what did he do to deserve that? And this is the thing, as you're reading through the story of Genesis, Abraham doesn't have a resume at all. In fact, within the plot line of Genesis, Abraham, and we miss this if you've read Genesis several times, you don't notice how odd it is, but in Genesis chapter 12, Abraham just kind of shows up on the scene. Nothing is said about him. He just kind of, here's this seemingly random guy. And God is making this incredible promise to him without any explanation of merit. Abraham merited this promise. Without any explanation of inherent virtue, he deserved these promises. In fact, within the plot line of Genesis, Abraham is set in contrast to the people of Babel. So Abraham comes onto the scene in Genesis chapter 12, but Genesis chapter 11 is about a people who built the city of Babel. And do you remember the people who would come to be known as the Babylonians, the people of Babel? What did they say? They said, and if you read chapter 11, they use this exact language. They say, we're going to make bricks. Listen to this language. It'll come up again in Exodus. We're going to make bricks. And with these bricks, we're going to build a city, a kingdom. And we're going to make a name for ourselves. We're going to make ourselves great. They literally said, Genesis 11:4, let us make a name for ourselves. Now, that's the spirit of Babel in Genesis 11. This is what we're going to do for ourselves. This is what we're going to build for ourselves. We're going to make ourselves great. We're going to make ourselves a nation. We're going to make ourselves a name. And what is God's response to that spirit? He confuses them. He says, no. That's not how it works. You don't tell me what you're going to do for yourself. And right after that account comes Abraham in chapter 12. Okay? This again, seemingly random guy. And God comes to Abram. And you know what he says to Abram? He says, I'm going to give you a great name. I'm going to make you a great nation. Okay? It's not about what you deserve. It's not about what you have earned. It's not about what you have worked for or what you're going to do for yourself. No, I am freely pledging myself to you. Because I choose to. Not because you've earned it or I have to, but I'm graciously, freely making you these promises. Okay, now, Abraham receives the promise. And there's a lot of occasions throughout Genesis and even into Exodus where it appears that God forgot his promise, right? Because here's the thing, you know, he promised Abraham he's going to make him a great nation. Abraham didn't have many kids at all. they couldn't have kids for a while. And when they were very old, he has Isaac by his wife. And even Isaac, he said, well, maybe that's where it just explodes. Well, no, Isaac actually only had two sons, and they were a hot mess, right? The younger son, Jacob, weaseled his way into the birthright, even though he was the younger of the two. And so the promise continues through him. He has 12 sons. Jacob has 12 sons. Those are the sons listed that we read about in Exodus chapter 1. But, you know, a family of 12 sons isn't exactly a great nation, is it? I mean, it goes on to say that they, you know, if you include the rest of the family, they numbered 70, and that's great, but that's a far cry from the promise that was made. That's a far cry from being considered a great nation. And what's interesting is, as you're reading through the story of Genesis, you expect to get to the end of Genesis because God's made these incredible promises in chapter 12 and chapter 15 and then reaffirmed them throughout the narrative. You expect to get to the end of Genesis and just see this great nation, this multitude of people that have come from Abraham living in the land that God had promised them. But when you get to the end of Genesis, you don't see any of that. You find this ordinary family who now isn't even living in the land that God had promised them because they had been driven out of that place by a famine that God sent onto the earth. Genesis ends with the covenant promises of God very much in question. But there's a glimmer of hope when you crack the pages of Exodus. So pick up with me in verse 5 of Exodus 1. It says, the total number of Jacob's descendants was 70. Joseph was already in Egypt. More about that later. Verse 6, Joseph and all of his brothers and all that generation eventually died. And then in verse 7, you get a glimmer of hope. It says, but the Israelites were fruitful, increased rapidly, multiplied, and became extremely numerous so that the land was filled with them. Now, at this point, it's been literally hundreds of years since the original promise was made to Abraham, but you see a glimmer of hope here at the beginning of the Exodus that maybe God is indeed starting to fulfill these promises. Okay. And this is a key theme that we're seeing here that we're going to see develop throughout the Exodus. It goes under the heading of promise. And this theme of promise reveals this first truth. This is number one. The Lord is a God whose covenant promises are faithful and free. This is what we're learning about the nature of this God. He's a God whose covenant promises are both faithful and free. And what I mean by free is they're not earned. They're freely given and received. We're learning something about the Lord, this God, Yahweh, that the nature of this God who reveals himself as the great I am is faithful. Is faithful. Listen, we're seeing even in the beginning of Exodus that the Lord does not break his promises. He's faithful. Now, before we consider the impact of that truth for us today, I want to first introduce a second theme that's being developed in the transition from Genesis to Exodus, and it goes under the heading of providence. Providence. Because there's another theme here about God's sovereign providence. We're going to see that this Lord, Yahweh, who has revealed himself to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, is a sovereign God. Okay? He's sovereign over Pharaoh. We're going to see that he is sovereign over the people of Egypt. They're going to start giving away their jewelry. He's sovereign over frogs and gnats and water and birds. He is sovereign over every aspect of the universe. And his sovereignty is particularly demonstrated in the narrative through his providence. His providence. This God, who is the great I Am, is directing the affairs of history. He's directing the affairs of lives such that his purposes are established. And what we discover as we're reading along in the narrative is that there is a particular mystery to the providence of God, meaning the people of God rarely understand the fullness of what God is doing in the world around them or in their own circumstances, in lives, while it's happening in the present. It's mysterious to us. We don't get it. In fact, not only does it confuse us, that the mysterious promise of God oftentimes strikes us as counterintuitive. And so you just think about it as it applies to the narrative here. Why did Israel leave the land where God had promised to give them and end up in Egypt? How did they get there? Why did they go there? Well, it's because God, the same God who gave the promise, sent a famine on the land. Right? And that famine drove them to Egypt. Do you remember? Remember the sons of Jacob had a brother named Joseph who they didn't like, and so they sold him into slavery, and he ends up in Egypt as a slave in Egypt. And from there, God, even though he was like a dead man, resurrected him and exalted him to be a chief ruler over the entire land. And it would be through that exact person that God would then provide for the sons of Jacob, to provide for them during this famine. So, in other words, the famine drove Jacob and his family out of the land of promise and into this other land where they would later become enslaved. Let me say that again. The people who sold their brother into slavery would, through the provision of that very brother, move to a place where they would ultimately become enslaved. What a coincidence. Only it's not some random chance, right? The author is revealing the providential hand of God. And here's the thing, church, like we know these stories. I mean, most of us, we grew up in the church and we've heard these things, and maybe they're new to you, but like, even now, we have the benefit of reading the whole story. We know how it ends. Like, we get to, as we start the story, we already know the ending of the story. We have that benefit of seeing the whole. But I want you to consider these people living through this history. Consider Jacob. Man, you know, he already thinks that he has lost one of his sons, Joseph. And now this famine has come onto the land that threatens to wipe out the rest of his family, such that he's going to have to leave the land that supposedly some God had promised to give to his granddad. Fast forward and consider the Hebrew people who were living as slaves in Egypt as the Exodus begins. And at some point, thinking to themselves, you know, we're not a great nation, are we? Can we even be considered a nation? We're a bunch of slaves living in a place sent here because of a famine that the God of the universe sent upon the world, and now we're enslaved. And it's the same God who made these promises to us. Church, this is the mysterious providence of God. It would have been incredibly confusing. Do you think at times Jacob and the Hebrew people, the characters in the story, experienced some fear, experienced some doubt, experienced some anger, and perhaps even bitterness toward the Lord? What is God doing? He makes these promises. He sends us to this place. It looks like he's saving us, but then we become enslaved. Has he forgotten us? Have we made him angry with us? Has he broken his promises? Maybe some of the gods of the Egyptians, maybe they're out there and they're greater than this God. All of these questions, what is God doing? But of course, they couldn't see the whole story. They couldn't see the reality that God was allowing the sins of the Amorites to come to its fullness, that God had a plan that he was orchestrating to display his glory and his power over Egypt and over Pharaoh to demonstrate to all of the nations that the great I Am is the God of heaven and earth. And see, what we're going to learn in the story of the Exodus is that it is oftentimes through famine, through slavery, that God accomplishes his purposes. That even through the famine and through the slavery, God had been present. He hadn't forgotten. He had been present with them all along, and he was working it all, orchestrating a great redemption. It's because of the famine, it's because of the slavery, that they would experience the power and the goodness of the great I Am. And so there's a second truth here that we see under this theme of providence. It's this, number two, the Lord is a God whose mysterious providence is trustworthy. Church, we need to be reminded of that truth. The Lord is a God whose mysterious providence is trustworthy. The biblical worldview never looks at history as a lucky or an unlucky spin of the wheel. Who knows what's going to happen? History is not moved forward by a series of random chances. That is true on the macro humanity and the history of the world. It is true on the micro. It is true of your life and what God is doing in your life. The great I Am is sovereignly directing the story of your life. And yes, at times his providence is mysterious to us. There will be times where we're confused by it. What is he doing? Why has he led me here? Why has he allowed this? He'll put us in places of famine and betrayal and hardship. And we'll experience that same anger and at times bitterness and confusion and doubt and fear. But the story of the Exodus reveals that while, yes, God's ways are mysterious, yes, it will also teach us that his heart is kind, and that his providence is trustworthy. He would say later through the prophet Isaiah, he would say it this way. He would say, my thoughts are not your thoughts. You have no idea what I'm doing here. He says, my thoughts are not your thoughts, and neither are my ways your ways, declares the Lord. And then he says, for as the heavens are higher than the earth, think about the expanse between the heavens and the earth. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways that much higher and more than your ways. And my thoughts than your thoughts. And we can't see it in the moment. We're in the situation. We're in the circumstance. We can't see it in the moment. But God is orchestrating something good, something grand. He's orchestrating his good, redemptive, glorious purposes in and through our lives. And here's the thing. He doesn't ask us to understand him as if we could, as if the pot could understand the potter. He doesn't ask us to get it. He simply asks us to trust him. And that's what we're going to see, that he is working into the hearts of the Israelites through the story of the Exodus, teaching them, refining their hearts, teaching them to trust him. I know you don't get it. You don't see it. You don't understand it. Trust me. The story of the Exodus will teach us that the Lord is a God whose covenant promises are faithful and free, and that he's a God whose mysterious providence is trustworthy. Now, there's one additional theme here that I want to introduce. But in order to see this theme, we have to not only see Genesis as the prequel to Exodus, as we've been looking at, but we also have to see Exodus as the prequel to Christ. Okay. Church, this is what I want you to keep in your mind as we're going through this book together. This story is a trailer. It's a preview. to a much larger story. We're going to see as we're going through the Exodus that the theme of purpose, and it's going to reveal this third and final truth, number three. The Lord is a God whose redemptive purpose is to deliver people from their slavery. He's a God of redemptive purpose. His purpose is to deliver people from their slavery. God, this Lord, this God is a God of purpose. And we see hints of that again in the very beginning of the book, in Exodus 1, verse 7. I'm going to reread verse 7. And if you've ever read the beginning of the Bible, the creation narrative, then the language of Exodus 1, 7 ought to sound familiar to you. Let me reread it. He says, "But the Israelites were fruitful, increased rapidly, multiplied, and became extremely numerous, so that the land was filled with them." That's the precise language of Genesis 1, when God created Adam and Eve, and he put them in the land, and he told them to be fruitful and multiply and to fill the earth, the land. It's the same word in the Hebrew, to fill the land that God had given them. You see, they bore the image of God, and as image bearers of God, they reflected the glory of God, and we're seeing something about the purpose of God here. God's purpose has always been to fill the earth with his glory through his people. And the language of Exodus 1:7 that triggers the thought of Genesis 1 clues us into the reality that through the story of the Exodus, God is continuing that purpose to fill the earth with his glory through his people. But the Exodus we know is not ultimate. The story of the Exodus is only a prequel to the story of Christ, who is the new Moses, who is the ultimate seed of Abraham, through whom the nations of the earth will be blessed. We understand that humanity is living in bondage, in slavery. We are slaves in a kingdom that is marked by hard labor and oppression. Only our oppressors are not Egyptian pharaohs and taskmasters. Ours is the oppression of sin dominating our hearts and the oppression of the experience of suffering and brokenness that sin has brought into the world, into our lives and our relationships. And just like Joseph had to be betrayed by his own people and be made like a dead man whom God would resurrect and exalt and give a seat of authority and through whom God would provide deliverance for his people, salvation for his people, in the same way Jesus, the greater Joseph, was betrayed by his own people and made an actual dead man and resurrected and exalted and given a place of authority. And that is through him that we can experience salvation from the spiritual famine that we are in. He is our Savior and Deliverer. He alone can set us free from the slavery in which we find ourselves. He sets us free from a kingdom that is marked by fear and oppression and hard labor, and delivers us to a kingdom that is marked by love, communion, and rest. That's what we'll see in the Exodus. This is the redemptive purpose of God. And we're going to see a little model of it, a little preview of it in this story called Exodus. This redemption, it's not just something that God did. It is available for you today. It is available for you today. If today your heart is still bound by fear, bound by turmoil, bound by strongholds of sin, If your heart is bound by that inner sense or that inner feeling that you have to do more, you have to produce more bricks in order to please this God, in order to prove yourself to this God, if that's where your heart is today, can I invite you to turn away from Egypt and to turn toward the great I Am, whose purpose is to fill the whole earth with his glory through your redeemed life. And that is something we would love the opportunity to talk to you more about even this morning. At the close of our service, we'll have some counselors available at the back of the room, and they would love to sit down with you and talk to you about what it means to experience the redemption of this God and the freedom that he provides. But I want to just say this, church. This story is not only for those who have never experienced the redemption of God. It's also for us who have. Because as I heard the great late Tim Keller once say, you can take the people out of slavery, but it takes time to get the slavery out of the people. We need this story. We need to be reminded to turn to Jesus, the one who at one point turned around to a people who were weighed down by burdens. And he said to them, come to me. Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. An Exodus. The Exodus is the story that points us to the ultimate rest that is found in the kingdom of Christ. It is the story that points us to the rest for the redeemed. Wait for his promises. Trust his providence and rest in his purpose to set you free.